Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Let's go. Put some energy.
What? I can yell too. I'm not intimidated.
All right. Three.
That was funny.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by the managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafaña. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis.
It's good to have you. And reporter Jacob McQuinney. What's up, Jacob McQuinney?
My ears are ringing. We just did a Reddit AMA for the Parents Guide, and there were so many good questions. And, you know, I'm still contemplating the nature of life.
Yeah, well, an AMA will do that. Coming up on the show this week, the primary may have seemed like a boring lemon, but we're going to squeeze some delicious lemonade out of it. We're not the place for your Biden-Trump angst. You come here for commentary on like the meaningless San Diego City Attorney primary. That's what you get here. We'll run through the races and more and look ahead to November. We have a big update as well on the scandal we explained many, many times on this show over the last couple of years. It's about the San Diego Housing Commission's purchase of a hotel during the pandemic that a new audit says cost way too much. Remember the broker who made bank on that deal with a side investment? Well, the audit reveals more, and it was really fun to read. It's going to be a good show. Stay with us. I feel like there were more people confused about this than should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Lopez,
yes.
You encountered a few yourself.
I would say three people.
They thought that the old rules were in place, and in the city of San Diego, in local races, if you got more than 50% of the vote in the primary, if a candidate got more than 50%, they went outright. They don't have to worry about the runoff.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the case, has not been the case for several years. But this was one of the, it's still early in the adaptation of this rule that no matter how much they get in the primary, they still have to do a runoff.
Someone asked me, like, so then what's the point of the primary?
When there's two candidates, there's no point.
Yeah.
Except there's a lot of point.
I'm going to go back to them and say that.
We'll talk about, because there's some ego point.
Yes.
There's some mo point, you know, momentum.
Okay.
But doesn't it also like feed the person who maybe didn't do as well? Like, I'm going to prove you wrong this time?
Maybe. We'll talk about that. Now, there is an exception to what I just said about not going to a runoff or having to go to a runoff. And that's because there is one race in the city of San Diego that looks like it has been resolved, and where the winner did get more than 50% of the vote in the city of San Diego, and they do get to be the next city council person, and that looks like it's going to be Henry Foster III. He ran to replace Monica Montgomery Stepp on the city council. His primary opponent was Chida Warren Darby, who runs boards and commissions, you know, putting people on boards and commissions for the mayor of San Diego, Todd Gloria. Henry Foster was the chief of staff of Monica Montgomery Step. He has more than 50%, and that means he will likely be able to be seated the moment the vote is certified, unless he loses a ton of ground over the next couple of weeks. That's a lot. That's a pretty good cushion in what will probably keep going at that rate. I didn't see his lead diminish over the night.
That's a pretty resounding victory. I mean, what do you think that says about this council district and what they think of Todd Gloria, what they think of Monica? I mean, if it tells us anything.
Well, I think that there's a couple of things at play here that were interesting. One is the Municipal Employees Association, the largest union of city employees, spent and supported Foster significantly. Uh-huh. He was sort of really gung-ho about their top priority, which is to raise the sales tax for the city of San Diego by a cent. He represented that sort of continuation of Monica Montgomery Step. So I think it shows like how popular she remains, and she supported him. But I think to the extent that there is a sort of proxy battle going on between the mayor of San Diego, Mayor Todd Gloria, and the council president, Sean Elo Rivera, and the mayor has four votes on the city council that kind of wanted to get rid of Sean Elo Rivera, and Sean Elo Rivera had four votes of support. Henry Foster is part of his allies and ready to support him again. And so that was a huge, to the extent there is a battle now between those two, Sean Elo Rivera came out of this election, I think, stronger.
Mm. Even though he kind of underperformed in his election, though.
Well, he got less. This is an interesting one, too. So, yeah, Sean Elo Rivera in District 9. This is the district that includes City Heights and Talmadge, Kensington. Very different neighborhoods, but all around there in the college area. He got 48% of the vote. And that was the lowest of the incumbent city council members running for re-election.
Yeah.
However, the police union spent a ton of money, at least comparatively, in that district against Elo Rivera and for Terry Hoskins, the police officer, retired police officer, who looks like he'll make it to the runoff with Sean Elo Rivera. And I think if you think about it, like the Whitburn got a ton of support in the opposite direction, you know, from the police and the Municipal Employees Association and others. So it's like Elo Rivera didn't really, he had a lot of support from the municipal employees. But I think like it kind of works out when you have that much spending against you like that. The Steve Whitburn race, the District 3 race, there wasn't a lot of money sloshing around there against him at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, but yeah, to the extent that Mayor Todd Gloria looks at that and says, I got more than you got, like 50, he got 50.1% or 51% about, and Sean Elo Rivera got, 48? Then that'll be interesting. Now, that said, let's talk about that race for a second. So Sean Elo Rivera, council president, he's got under a ton of criticism, especially in his neighborhood. Now, this is a very low turnout election with a more conservative, by far more conservative turnout, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he still got 48%. So now, in November, there's going to be a ton more Democrats voting, a ton more people on the left voting, more people who are less engaged in politics because of the presidential race and other races. There'll be a lot more turnout. It feels like the physics are in place for him to really have a much easier time against Terry Hoskins, a former police officer. Now, Hoskins will benefit again from the police officer's support, and he'll be able to gather all that sort of angst from the Talmadge Kensington world. But there'll be just a real groundswell at that point from City Heights, and that should protect Elo Rivera, it seems like. But I mean, we'll see. Never know what's going to happen as far as populist movements getting together. But, and I want to point out there's a related note here. We've talked, and I've reported, and we've talked about the race between Kevin Faulkner, former mayor of San Diego, and Tara Lawson Reamer, the county supervisor. Faulkner wants to oust her from that seat, become a county supervisor, and they're going at each other. There was some signs up. We talked about them, but they were not on the ballot, because there's only two of them, and county races also now have to go to the November runoff no matter what. But the county has just taken the step of, if there's only two candidates, then that's don't the put them on the primary. The city, for some reason, just hasn't gotten there. They're like, well, we still should. They're still running.
It's like a vibe. We're already doing it. Just keep them.
Well, San Diego Unified, similar. They at least, you know, for example, Sabrina Bazzo,
yes,
was up against Crystal Troll. Sabrina Bazzo, current board member. Crystal Troll, who is a professor over at USD, was challenging her for that position, and they were both on this primary, despite the fact that there are only two of them.
Right, and they still have to go. Now, this mm-hmm. is, again, we're in the second cycle since they switched those elections to only being in their neighborhoods mm-hmm. and not in the overall city.
Yeah, and I will say it was a very, very impressive result for Crystal. I mean, I think she got 48% of the vote, so I'll be paying close attention to what things look like as we get closer to November.
Right. Yeah, so let's talk about District 3. That's the San Diego City Council race. That's Stephen Whitburn. He is the incumbent. He got 54% of the vote. But we are on the edges of our seats. I mean, don't fall off, Lopez. to see who goes with him, lawyer Colleen Cusack, who represents a lot of homeless individuals and other people at the edges of society, is in a tight battle with Kate Callan, former journalist, who represents more of that sort of protect the neighborhood vibe. Mm-hmm. She and they're in a tight race. Colleen Cusack has a lead right now of about 306 votes. Mm-hmm. Nothing out of about 20,000 casts. So there's a lot of room for that to change over the next couple of days as more counts come in. This is Thursday. We'll have a new update tonight, and then a couple more, and hopefully we'll get some clarity by next week. But that's a big one.
Whitburn made a lot of news this past year, especially with his, pushing of the camping ban. And Colleen is somebody who has been very, very vocally opposed to the camping ban. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think this says about what D3 residents feel about this kind of most high profile of Whitburn's accomplishments?
I think that this could go to the mayors too. I think there was a lot of us eggheads looking at all of this and saying, boy, these incumbents are in trouble. There's a lot of criticism on both sides, about how they're handling everything, about the quality of life in the city. And there's no question. Even some of their own polls showed that, some of the approval issues and such were bad. But uh-huh. I think this shows that at least among this group, there was sort of a coming home for them, that they weren't willing to throw them out. They weren't willing to really turn out for any of these opponents. But also there's not a lot of money and movement coming around these opponents, that these folks are smart and making good cases, maybe, but they're not penetrating through with some name ID or anything. All right, but the biggie is, of course, the mayor of San Diego. This is another one people thought, boy, he's in trouble. He's got a lot of critics on all the sides. Mayor Todd Gloria, at last count, was at 51% of the vote, 79,000 votes over its closest competitor, 38,000 votes, Larry Turner. Now, Larry Turner is the undisputed second place here. He's the police officer, and he is going to go to the runoff.
Much to the chagrin of Gloria's people, right? If we understand it correctly, they put big money into Glasson trying to boost her.
The only Republican in the race, Jane Glasson, who is the beneficiary of thousands and thousands of dollars spent by Mayor Todd Gloria's allies to try to boost her. She got 7% of the vote so far, nowhere near the 25 necessary to make the runoff. Maybe she siphoned a few votes from Larry Turner, maybe, if that was the goal, but that didn't have much to do with it. She did not make the primary or the runoff.
Do these groups ever have moments like, wow, that was a waste of some cash?
I don't know. Maybe.
You just have so much cash, you're like,
got to try something. I don't know. They did support a challenge, though, to Larry Turner that now is going to get a lot of attention. March 29th, there's going to be a court hearing about whether Larry Turner lived in San Diego when he said he did in order to be eligible to run for mayor.
Well, and this wouldn't really have mattered, right, if he wouldn't have made the runoff. But now that he has made the runoff, this could shift things significantly, right? Because if they do rule him ineligible to run, then all of a sudden we have a new second person in the runoff, which is Genevieve Jones-Wright.
Yeah. So all eyes will be on that hearing about that. Just to review the facts of the case, he lived in a house that he and his wife owned in El Cajon, sort of Alpine area. He voted there in 2020. He voted there in 2022. He says and claims that he moved to a condo downtown owned by...
red-blooded, in-and-out-eaten American... What is his name again? I can't even remember.
Giorgio. Giorgio was his campaign manager, had an East Village apartment that Larry Turner and his family moved into, mm-hmm. his wife and two young kids in this East Village condo. And he registered to vote there and later decided to move his family to Ocean Beach. But the only real residence that matters is the East Village apartment. Mm-hmm. So did he actually do that? Did he move there? Did he check all the boxes necessary to make that work? And that's going to be the big question. Now, the mayor's allies say, no, he didn't. He, you know, they sent private investigators to go check it out. Never saw it. He can't produce the kind of utility receipts and such that would show that he lived there. He says he can. That'll be what the court's all about.
It's fascinating. I mean, we saw this, a couple years ago with the campaign in Chula Vista, Mayor John McCann and Amara Campanajar. Lots of questions floating about whether, you know, Amara Campanajar lived in Chula Vista, but I think it's fascinating that they've got, like, PIs watching people.
It was the same PI.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah, it was the same. Now, that was different.
This guy's getting a lot of work.
Yeah.
Now, that was a little different and interesting because they never really challenged that Amara Campanajar had a house there or that he had a residence there. What they said is that he wasn't connected to the community.
Present.
He didn't live there. Mm-hmm. And their evidence was that he was staying over at his girlfriend's house, which is like one of the rights of a, you know, mid-20s individual, I believe.
But what is a home? Like, home is where my dog is.
Yeah.
You know? And if my dog is in an East Village condo, is that where my home is?
Right.
How do they make that determination?
I mean, legally, I don't think a judge will buy that your home is where your dog is, but I'm not a judge.
What is a home?
Well, I think that John McCann's case against Amara Campanajar was that he doesn't care about Chula Vista.
Yes, he's just not even spending time.
Yeah, he was parachuting in. He was desperate to be in elected office, which, I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with him being desperate to be in elected office, but it was sort of a vibe question, right? Like, does this guy really care about Chula Vista if he's you know, hanging out with Sarah Jacobs every night?
That's why I always said, like, you don't need to, like, stake him out. You can just say, like, you don't have connection here. You don't care about it.
Yeah.
And that's why this doesn't necessarily apply to Larry Turner, because he does have a pretty strong connection to San Diego.
Yeah.
He's in the community and been working in the community. It's like the opposite almost. They're trying to prove that he doesn't have a legal residence here, even though his vibes are better suited here, right? But I think that one other big point is this is a police officer. So if there's any, like, truth to, like, him sort of trying to deceive or get around or actually violate the law, like, that's also kind of bad, right?
Are there legal ramifications for this? I mean, could he?
Yes, that's that they're arguing that he basically lied.
Yeah.
On, you know, these forms, which is, you know, illegal.
So what happens? Does the judge make him, like, move back to El Cajon? What's the legal?
Well, they throw him off. I don't know if there's any ethics or prosecutorial thing on there, but you know, as we look at the runoff, the police union spent a bunch of money trying to get Terry Hoskins on the ballot in District 9 in the runoff, and you know, supporting Chida Warren Darby in District 4, but they have not come out for him, Larry Turner, and I think that's that there's something in that silence right now, and I don't know what it is.
Who did they come out for anybody?
For Hoskins, right?
No, I mean in the mayor's race.
Oh. No.
Oh. They were just crickets.
Yeah, like
even
there's
like
a cop on the
come
ballot.
Out against Genevieve Jones?
Well, they don't like her very clearly. They're
they
not going to endorse her. But again, they have Todd Gloria, who they've had a ton of problems with over the last several years.
Oh, yeah.
And they have Genevieve Jones Wright, who they do not like.
But he wants to.
And they have a cop on the ballot, and they're not supporting him. That to me means that there's something going on.
What do you think this says about how the race will shape up between Gloria and someone like Turner?
Well, if Turner is able to get his Bill Walton supporters, that world of like mm-hmm. guys who want to see the everything get shook up and get things cleaned up in the city, if he gets them to spend money, that's the only thing that can make a difference here, is if they put in a couple hundred grand to start doing a bunch of ads and start really, because to get an incumbent out of office, you have to A, convince the public that they need to be fired, and B, convince the public that your candidate is the one that should take that spot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard lift. It takes a lot of money to do that across a city of, you know, what, 1.5 million people.
Well, especially for somebody who really doesn't have any name ID. I mean, Larry Turner's not a figure, despite the fact that he's been to community planning works arguing against this and arguing for that. He's not, you know, a Todd Gloria or a Faulkner or, you know, even a Carl DeMaio.
Yeah. He's very well known in the Voice of San Diego universe, though.
Larry Turner is. Okay, well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I feel like a lot of people I, you know, spoke with and, you know, those that shared who they were voting for mayor, they were like, oh, like, you know, I don't really like Gloria and I wish she was doing something differently, but like, I don't really know the rest of these people.
All right, this is the vibes race that I thought was fascinating. San Diego City Attorney, of course, we've talked about this a lot. This is the person who oversees all of the legal attorney work of the city of San Diego, but also the prosecutions of misdemeanors. Mara Elliott is termed out. Her chief deputy, Heather Ferbert, is running for that office. But also Brian Mainschein, an assemblyman, former city councilman at the city of San Diego. He had all the endorsements. He was all over all the mailers for the Democratic Party. He got the mayor's endorsement, a lot of support around institutions of the county. But Heather Ferbert, who had billboards, that's it, just some billboards, and some pretty sharp tongue criticism of the fact that Brian Mainschein hasn't practiced law in decades. She got 52.29% so far, and he has 47.71%. Again, this is just a vibes race. It'll still go on to the runoff, but I bet she has a lot more friends today than she did a week ago. I bet you her phone rang, and it's like, hey, Heather, wow, you did great. How about that? It's a really interesting thing. How do you think you did it? Like, I bet you she's getting a lot of that, and she's like probably kind of liking it, and I bet she gets more money. I bet she gets more endorsements because they see her now as the winner. And again, it gets back to like, we saw this movie before. 2016, Mara Elliott was running. She was the chief deputy city attorney. She had $0. Rafael Castellanos and Gil Cabrera had tons of money. They were racking up endorsements all over. Gil Cabrera gets the endorsement of the Union Tribune. The party is really coalescing around these two. These are going to be the really interesting ones. Mm-hmm. And they got smoked by her in the primary. In part and almost wholly because her name on the ballot said chief deputy city attorney. Everybody's like, who should be city attorney? They look at it like, well, the chief deputy city attorney.
She's already kind of has the job.
Yeah, that's almost the same job title.
Who's this other guy?
And now another guy getting all the endorsements and all the vibes. And there's the chief deputy city attorney on the ballot. And she smokes him in the primary. Now, again, it doesn't matter and he can get something together. But how does he overcome that when it's going to be like more, you know, or less informed voters, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it seems like, again, I bet she's got a lot of new friends.
You know, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot with this race is, you know, Mainschein he's somebody who has dreams beyond the city attorney, you know? He wants to be attorney general. I mean, how does this affect his hopes and dreams of reaching that kind of pinnacle of attorneyness, despite the fact that he is not necessarily the pinnacle of an attorney?
You know, he'll figure something out. He'll run like, I don't know. He's the kind of guy that's going to, his life's fine.
Oh, he's going to be fine. He's going to be okay.
He's just, he may not get to be attorney general, at least yet. I don't know.
Dream big.
Okay, a couple other items of note. So Carl DeMaio, our old friend, the talk show host, former city councilman, decided to get back into politics himself, ran for this assembly seat that Marie Waldron is vacating. And according to Politico, quote, he is smoking Republican establishment pick Andrew Hayes in San Diego and in line to cruise past a Democrat in November. I'm not ready to say it yet, guys. I think this is a heavy, heavy Republican district, but Carl DeMaio's at 44%. He's going to make the runoff. Kevin Juza, the Democrat, is at 19.02%. But that's a much smaller margin above Andrew Hayes, the other Republican, than it was at the start of the night when the first count came up. So I think there's Andrew Hayes is about, 2,140 votes away from Kevin Juza, the Democrat. And so that's less of a margin than it was when the count first came out. So as more counts come out, I'm not sure you can write off Hayes yet. And if Hayes does make that runoff versus DeMaio, I still say DeMaio has the advantage, but boy, that's going to get nasty because everyone who doesn't like DeMaio on the right and the left is probably going to see a chance to punch him there. And he's going to love being the guy that they're coming after.
It's lucky for him that he doesn't have many enemies.
Yeah. So that's something to watch. Another one we mentioned before, Margarita Wilkinson wanted to run against Mike Levin in the 49th congressional district, but Matt Gunderson has overtaken her and will go to the runoff in that seat. So that's one of the few sort of Republican hopes to pick up in congressional races in Southern California. I want to make one point about the Senate race. The Congressman Adam Schiff is going to go to the runoff with the Republican former baseball star Steve Garvey. And the Katie Porter's very mad about this. The Congresswoman, she called it rigged that so much money was spent against her.
And also partly on Garvey.
Yeah, right? That she hates that thing that Garvey was being pumped by Schiff. But we talked about this. Like this is what you're doing in these primaries. Carl DeMaio did it. Todd Gloria's allies did it to some extent. You see this all the time. You try to pick your opponent. Schiff banking that in very blue California that they're not going to go for a Republican like Steve Garvey.
Yeah,
it's probably a good bet. And he's able to, he says, save that money and support other Democrats. Now she's saying that it's going to bring out a lot of Republicans and hurt Democrats. But I think there's one interesting note about this. So we used to have two senators, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein from the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And now we have, if Schiff wins, we'll have two senators, Schiff and Alex Padilla from LA. So from the Bay Area used to control state politics and losing a little of its spot.
Yeah, California's power center is slowly shifting south. Maybe one day it'll get down here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
So we talked about Andrea Cardenas and the gift of the plea that she got from the San Diego district attorney. She, of course, pleaded guilty to grand theft against the United States of America. In her fraud of PPP loan funds, she resigned her seat on the city council. She's still on the ballot, though, to be reelected. And there are two people from Chula Vista District 4, the city council seat, who are going to move on to the runoff. Cesar Fernandez looks like he definitely will. But Rudy Ramirez, former city councilman, is only about 1.5 points ahead of Andrea Cardenas. He's only about...
85 votes.
85 votes, yeah. Ahead of her about 3,000 or 4,000 votes cast. So that's another one that could flip over the next few days. So she could get reelected after this.
And if she is, her attorney said she would serve.
Yeah, she's ready.
That would be such a baller move, man.
Oh, the Cardenas are back, man. They're that plea deal.
Did they ever really leave?
No, not really, apparently. Okay, last on the ballot, this is a big deal, and yet it was really hard to explain. I cannot tell you how many people, friends and family, asked me about Proposition 1, what they should do on it, and, mm-hmm. and I would always start to explain it, and it's one of those things you start to explain, and it's like, after like 20 seconds, you're like, I'm
sure
not
making it. Explaining.
They are not understanding a word I'm saying.
Their eyes are glazing. Is that like your greatest pet peeve because you love explaining stuff?
When I don't know how to explain uh-huh. things well,
yeah,
it's torture. Yeah, it's the absolute worst. So it is really close. So Proposition 1 statewide is up 50.3% to 49.7%. So out of 4 million votes almost counted statewide, it is only up less than 27,000 votes. That's wild. That could continue to shift in the state or in the county of San Diego. It is losing.
In the county of San Diego, it is the mirror opposite of the state.
Yeah.
So statewide, the yes has 50.3 and the no has 49.7. And countywide, the no has 50.3 and the yes has 49.7.
That's wild.
San Diegans were not vibing.
No, apparently not.
Someone asked me what it was yesterday, and then I somewhat attempted to explain. I don't know that I did very well. And I was like, what did you vote? And they're like, I just missed it. I didn't vote on it because it was so confusing.
Well, I mean, that right there, despite all of the money that and you know, juice that Gavin Newsom has dropped into this attempt to get people to vote yes, if it fails, that's the problem.
Lemon
right?
juice.
It was complicated and people did not understand it. And either they did not do enough messaging or clear enough messaging to make it clear for people exactly what they were voting for.
Yeah, just to be clear, this is a tax that already exists on people who make $1 million or more per year. It's an income tax. It was already in place, but what it did was shift it. So all the money that was collected, instead of going to counties for drug and mental health care, it would allow the state to borrow a bunch of money and use these funds to pay off that borrowing, to pay off that loan. And that money would be used in large part to build more places where people could get treatment and actual housing for homeless individuals. So it's kind of like the keystone part of Governor Gavin Newsom's attempt to kind of redo the whole way that the state approaches and really go back to where you can put people in facilities, and we're going to build facilities where you can put them, and you know, it's really core. But it got a lot of conservative opposition too, even though it's an existing tax. It funded a lot of rural things that they were worried about losing, but also they just don't like him and wanted to keep pushing against that. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to see the shift in funding occur. The Mental Health of Association, the Howard Jarvis Tax Payers Association. So there are also people who support mental health issues who thought that it was too severe and would be a problem. So it's going to be tight, and that would have major impact. Or at least Halberstadt did some good work analyzing the impact it would have in San Diego. So stay tuned on that one. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Do you guys remember the pandemic?
Vaguely.
So,
like
especially
a bad
early
dream.
On, the first couple months were a blur.
I kind of liked it at first. Yeah, I was like in my PJs.
It was like an extended snow day or something, you know?
Well, during the pandemic, there was a lot of people who had been moved to the convention center because the shelters were too tightly packed and there was this urgent need. So the convention center didn't have obviously any business, so they transformed it into this emergency homeless shelter. And the idea spread throughout the state that because these hotels, hotels all across the state were losing so much business, that there might be some good deals on those hotels and that we should take that opportunity as taxpayers to purchase hotels and use them for long-term housing for a lot of these individuals, especially hotels like the extended stay types that have little little kitchens and stuff. This is kind of a perfect place to live if you're formerly homeless. Now, the mayor of San Diego, Kevin Faulkner, really jumped on this first, pushed it pretty hard. The Housing Commission eventually got it together and purchased a lot of different things, but there was two hotels in particular that they bought in 2020. And then there was some concern about it. So I'm actually going to let a city attorney explain part of this. This was in September 2022. City attorney handling this case for the city was explaining to the council what happened.
In 2020, Jim Neal, a broker in the Kidder Matthews firm, served as a real estate consultant and broker who represented the Housing Commission in two hotel transactions. Kidder and Neal's contract with the Housing Commission set a $250,000 cap on the commission that Kidder and Neal would earn for each transaction. Kidder and Neal received a commission of $592,000 for the Kearney Mesa transaction and $502,500 for the Hotel Circle property, which was paid by the Housing Commission. The Housing Commission later learned that Mr. Neal purchased 40,000 shares of stock in the parent company of the seller of the Hotel Circle property after presenting the property to the Housing Commission for consideration and before the transaction closed.
Okay, it later learned that because our investigative reporter Andy Keats revealed it and revealed that this guy had done this investment and that investment had turned out quite lucrative for him. Now, I love how she delivers it because it's so dry, but it was such a corrupt thing. He told them you should buy this place. They say, that's a good idea. We'll buy this place. And then he invested in the owner of the place and then they bought the place. And it's just like, it's like, you could not have a more corrupt series of events.
Well, in his timely investment, I mean, led to profiting of what was it, like between $230,000 and $353,000?
That's just in the investment, never mind the commission that he got for recommending this purchase. The Union Tribune a few years ago had revealed, like, boy, they may have spent too much on these hotels. Keats later figured out like this investment had happened and was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, what's up with this broker who made an investment in this? And they're like, well, nothing to see here. Don't worry about it. But Keats made another observation and reporting insight after this, which was that part of the reason that they spent so much for the hotels was that the appraisal for the hotel, one of the hotels in Hotel Circle in Mission Valley, had been, the appraisal had been made for before the pandemic as a functioning hotel when they were purchasing it during the pandemic when nobody was staying there.
Yeah, which essentially went against the entire purpose of this program, which,
this idea.
Which was created specifically to kind of scoop up distressed hotels amidst, you know,
price.
The pandemic at a deal, at a bargain bin price.
So Keats and we on this show kept wondering, like, why would they use that appraisal? Why would they use that appraisal?
Yeah.
Why would they use that appraisal? Because that was an appraisal of a property in a different situation than it was in. And this point consistently got dismissed by city officials and others. Now, two housing commissioners brought it up. Like, what about this thing? And they were pretty routinely like pushed aside.
Mm-hmm.
Mara Elliott, the San Diego city attorney, eventually decides to sue this guy, the broker, and his firm. And as she's discussing the settlement she eventually comes up with, she says, like, these concerns about the appraisal don't fit here. It's not my problem. Here was her in September 2022.
So if there is any dissatisfaction, then those who are appointed to that board should be asking questions. And that appraisal for those properties were before them. Nothing changed in those appraisals that they voted on. But now it's an issue. And I need to come in there and try to get a redo for them. That is not a fair request to our office.
This exchange happened. You might remember we talked about this on the show. This exchange happened because she had touted a settlement that she had made with this company and with this broker, where they would essentially agree to give the city $1 million, partly to recompense it for the commissions that it took, but also for their attorney's fees.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed not to do work for the city again, or at least this guy can't do work again for the city. And she had promoted this settlement. The city council was upset that she had promoted this settlement because they knew it was controversial and they wanted to have a chance to discuss it and approve it before she promoted it. And so remember that this broke out into this big fight, and it was the first of two or three times that she has claimed that they were trying to muzzle her.
But I find that the rules that have been applied to me have been very different than any of my predecessors. And I'll note for the record, I'm the first woman to hold this position. And if I want to say something, I'm going to say something. If there is a privilege that I have to respect, I will speak with the council. But the public expects to hear from me, and I will not be silenced.
So that was her saying, like, I'm going to tell you about this settlement. And again, really defending. And there were a couple of city council members were really proud of this settlement and her work on it. Here was Marnie Von Wilper, city council member, who just got 100% of the vote in her reelection campaign.
This is a great settlement, and I think we should be proud of it. We got taxpayer money back, and we are housing unsheltered people in two hotels. So great work, Megan. Thank you for everything.
And here's Joe LaCava, city councilman.
I'm comfortable with that purchase price back in the day. I'm comfortable with this settlement agreement. Brilliant work.
Okay, now, this week, the city auditor released an audit about this whole situation. And it found, like, oh, that they did a lot of things right, but they got one thing wrong. They way overvalued this hotel. And they claim it was almost $7 million that they spent too much on this hotel.
Yeah.
I think that figure is millions here or there. It didn't matter. They say the main thing, though, was that they overvalued it because they used an appraisal from before the pandemic and not during the pandemic, when the hotel would have been worth a lot less.
Essentially, it was a 10% premium that they paid, right? The audit found that had they appraised the hotel at the time of the purchase, they would have paid 10% or $6.7 million less than they ended up paying for it.
Right. Again, go back to that discussion about the settlement. And there was a lot of people saying, including Keats through his reporting and the quotes that he was getting, was like, we need to understand why they used that appraisal because it feels corrupt as heck.
Yeah.
This is, why is that? It feels like one of these like things you do to juice the price of something, mm-hmm. especially when there's a corrupt individual banking and making money off of this. And so we need to understand that maybe before you settle, like what happened here. And Keats has a revelation. He read deeply into this audit and he saw this awesome part. He said the appraisal firm who did these appraisals provided the auditors with an email from this broker saying the commission, the Housing Commission's legal counsel, only wanted an appraisal from before COVID. None of the agency's staff or the legal counsel received an email, that email. The appraisal said that it told Neil that an as-is appraisal that accounted for the pandemic would value the property lower, but he insisted that it be an appraisal from before the pandemic. The Housing Commission asked for these valuations, but they couldn't get it. Now, Keats asked the city attorney if it knew about this email where this guy, the broker, you know, insists that they use an appraisal from before the pandemic. And the city attorney's office says, quote, although settlement discussions are confidential and cannot be disclosed, it is important to note that the client determines whether to settle the case. You see what she's doing there?
She's pushing it off onto the Housing Commission.
The city, yeah.
The city.
The city council. She's saying, like, maybe I didn't want to settle the case.
but
these guys made me.
Wanted me.
Remember, earlier she's like, we settled the case.
Yeah.
And I want to tell everybody about it. And everybody's like, you shouldn't tell it. We have some concerns and we want to talk about it. And you should let us know first. And she's like, no, we settled the case. We already did this. It's great. And everybody's like, this is a great settlement. And now they're like, we didn't settle it. The client, the city settled. It's just classic.
That's some great guilt shifting, right?
Yeah. A couple of notes. This is 190 units and people are living there and they're not on the streets. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal. And there is, I think, credible evidence that the amount of money that the Housing Commission spent and the city spent on this hotel, that valuation has gone up. And so it's been a good investment. I think that's fair to say. But all those things can be true and you still maybe paid more for it than you needed to, in part because the broker who was involved in the ownership of the company that was selling it told you to, and that he corruptly engineered that the appraisal for it boost the property value of it.
Because mm-hmm. he would benefit from that.
Those things can all be true still.
Yeah.
And it's just an amazing sort of update to this scandal. Keats had a big role in uncovering. And Ryan Klumpner, he's quoted in Keats's update about this. He says, it's unfortunate we only receive these answers a year and a half after the case against Neil was settled when we have no recourse. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, this...
And Klumpner being a Housing Commission board member.
Right, right. So that's it. There's now been official determination by the city auditor that they spent too much or they overpaid for this. That's just too bad. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in San Diego. Get the newsletter for this podcast. That's the actual show to alert you that it's out with more links and show notes, updates from our team at vosd.org/newsletters. This is the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in San Diego that has its own dedicated newsletter with those specific links and updates from Voices team. That's vosd.org/newsletters, vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez Villafana is our managing editor. Jacob McQuinney's education reporter. Nate John's our excellent producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.